The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
And the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. 50 years ago, if you were an athlete practicing or playing in the unforgiving heat, water breaks were unthinkable.
Well, did you ever hear of giving a hot, sweaty football player all the cold drink he wants? Never.
The belief was the longer you could stay off of anything, the better your performance would be.
And the longer you play without it, the tougher you are, and the tougher you are, the meaner you are, and the meaner you are, you'll be the better player.
So anybody that said, hey, coach, can I have a water break, was perceived to be a little bit less than tough.
It's a wonder we all didn't cramp up and die.
That's a clip from one of ESPN's 30 for 30 documentaries, and it's called The Sweat Solution, which chronicles the history of Gatorade. Now, we don't usually devote segments to brand name products, but this one was a doozy. It began as an experiment to help the Florida Gators football team stave off debilitating dehydration during practice. 50 years later, Gatorade remains the most successful non-carbonated beverage in the U.S. Neil Amder is co-director of The Sweat Solution, and we spoke to him earlier when the documentary first came out. I asked him for some background on Robert Cade, the doctor who invented Gatorade.
Well, he is truly a Renaissance man, someone whose interests were as diverse as Studebakers, collecting Studebakers, playing the violin, growing flowers, and also just an excellent source of energy and enthusiasm for renal medicine, which he brought to the University of Florida when he came there in the early 60s. And he assembled a team of researchers, and in response to the Florida football team's need for solving this dilemma that they had of players going to the hospital with dehydration and loss of 20 pounds as much in a workout in the summer, Dr. Cade, this quirky little guy, decided to create a solution that has become and changed the whole face of sports training.
So how did he test it, and who did he test it on?
Well, what happened was, what was interesting, the coach at the time, Ray Graves, wouldn't allow Dr. Cade and his researchers to work with the varsity players, but he would allow them to experiment with the freshmen. So they literally bottled the sweat of the players who were in sweatsuits and gloves and to try to find out what was in the sweat that they could replenish. And after looking through it and deciding what they had to replace, they came up with a solution that initially tasted so bad that the players themselves really, really hated drinking it. It was Dr. Cade's wife, Mary, who had suggested changing the solution to a lemony kind of taste. And so what they did was they squeezed lemons one night and brought that solution back to the players. P.S., Gatorade as we know it.
It's just such a funny little clip in the film where his wife just says, add lemons.
Yeah, she's a terrifically interesting woman, and the daughter, Phoebe Cade Miles, who is now launched and has put into play the Cade Museum in Gainesville for research and development, is an extension of Dr. Cade's contributions to medicine.
Well, what is the secret to Gatorade? Why does it actually work?
I think probably the solution is that they came up with what actually was being lost in athletic performance. And water was not necessarily the most conducive in the sense that you tended to get heavy-weighted, and I think the Gatorade got through your system much faster so that the players could respond to that. And what happened was when they tried this with the varsity in 1966, the football team, not only did they have a Heisman Trophy-winning quarterback in Steve Spurrier, but the team was winning these comebacks in the second half of football games. And people were astonished when they went 7-0, went to a national ranking. And how did they do this? And that's when I wrote the first story on Gatorade in 1966 for the Miami Herald.
Wow, so you were really early on this one.
I was covering the Florida football team, and some of the opponents were kind of startled at how the Gators looked so fresh in the fourth quarter. And I had gotten a lead when I was up there one weekend and talked to Dr. Cade, and he explained this to me. And I wrote the story in the Herald. And then, of course, what happened was one of the great mysteries, which is in the film, interestingly enough, somehow or another, when they went to play the University of Georgia in their rivalry in Jacksonville, the Gatorade never arrived for the game. And no one could figure out whether the truck that was sending it got hijacked, whether there was some other mysterious circumstances. But the players didn't have the Gatorade. P.S. They lost after leading at halftime. They were beaten badly 27-10. And that's when the myth of Gatorade continued to expand as to something that could improve athletic performance.
We're talking with the veteran sports writer and editor Neil Amder about a film that he co-directed about the history and origins of Gatorade, truly a revolutionary drink in the world of sports. How did it make the jump from the Florida Gators football team to mass marketed to the general public for dehydration?
Interesting question, because in the film, Dr. Cade is quoted as saying that they never really made the drink for and never thought that they would be taking this to the general public. But I think when the word got out that Florida had this solution that was developed, what happened was Dr. Cade, who wanted it obviously to be something that would benefit, and interestingly enough, in the film as well, there's a segment when his daughter and a nurse talks about how Gatorade was being used at Chan's Hospital, a children's hospital in Gainesville, for newborn babies who were also suffering severe dehydration. And this is something that became instituted into the general medical practices in using Gatorade and that type of electrolyte solution to help with that. And I think what happened was other schools started to get the word out on Gatorade, and they started to develop it. And then they created a Gatorade Trust among the researchers there, sold the product initially to Stokely Van Camp, which began to market it, and subsequently it started to grow from there. And it has continued to grow over the years, and the statistics don't lie. I mean, in 2001, they had sold 339 million cases of Gatorade. Yeah. In 2013, which is the last year that they had it, they sold 632 million cases. So the increase is significant at a time when a lot of other of the sugary drinks are losing among health-conscious consumers. And here is Gatorade, which is continuing to show growth.
Well, we're talking about hydration all the time, not just for people who are engaged in sports, but it really is difficult to imagine a time when staying hydrated was not mandated for athletes.
I think it's definitely true. And I think part of what the evolution of these, a lot of the different sports training techniques developed. I mean, today it would be so much more difficult under NCAA regulations for a coach to authorize an experiment on a campus using football players as so-called guinea pigs in an experiment,
right,
keeping in mind this was 1965. But I think what is happening is that when you have visionaries who are able to see through these kinds of things and are able to see the benefits, you're seeing it in a lot of other areas as athletes become much more attuned to weight machines today than they were, let's say, back in the 60s when maybe they jog a little. Now everyone is into year-round conditioning, staying in shape. Much more weight training is done out of the season than it was done. And I think we're getting better athletes. We're getting more finely tuned. You're getting more women involved with marathons and training today than we've ever had before. And I think this is a sign that the public has become much more health conscious.
Well, Neil Amter, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, and best wishes to you, and stay warm up there.
Thank you. Neil Amter of Amter Productions, it's a multimedia company. He's also former sports editor for the New York Times. He co-directed, along with David Bailenson, ESPN's The Sweat Solution. It's the history of Gatorade. And you can find a link to watch the film at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Think your kid has what it takes to become a professional athlete? Well, think again. We'll take a look at some of the dream-crushing statistics of going pro when Word of Mouth continues. Percent of parents with high school-age children who play sports hope that their child will one day go pro. The reality is that the vast majority of star high school athletes won't even make their college team. KJ Dell'Antonia is lead writer and editor of the New York Times Motherlode blog, where she wrote about the pitfalls of fantasizing about raising a professional athlete. KJ, always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so 26% of parents think their kid's going to be the next Clayton Kershaw or Alex Morgan. Let's burst that bubble. What is the reality?
Well, first of all, it's 26% of parents of a high school athlete overall. But the numbers are even higher for low-income and lower-educated parents. I think it's in the 40s of low-income and less-educated parents hope that their kids will go pro. So that's a pretty depressing number. Realistically, you can get the numbers for how many high school athletes are likely to play in college, and then you can get the numbers for how many college athletes are likely to go on to the majors in whatever their sports are.
Mm-hmm.
I did the numbers for baseball, and I came up with really, it's 1 in 1,000 that a high school baseball player ever even sets foot in a major league game, and that says nothing about their level of success.
Wow, that is a pretty dismal success rate. I wonder if those who did these studies had any thoughts on why it's more prevalent in lower-income families.
Well, I think, you know, it's depressing, but it's definitely seen as a ticket out and maybe something that is accessible. I think that sports can be tough for really low-income families. They can be expensive, tough to get your kids to the field, tough to find a good league. But when you're sort of the middle-of-the-road family, that might be a place that it seems reasonable to invest your money. Parents are often also deceived about the odds of their kids getting a college scholarship out of their athletic career, and it must seem like an accessible dream.
What are those odds of getting a college scholarship for an athletic career?
A college scholarship, overall, it's a little hard to break down, but it looks like you're talking something like 3% of high school athletes in all sports overall. You can actually find the numbers of high school athletes that are likely to play on a college team in Division I, Division II, and Division III. Division III actually isn't allowed to give athletic scholarships, so you can wash that out right across the board, although some parents will say, sure, but the athletic process might influence other scholarships. That's really hard to break down. But the numbers of high school students who even get to play in college, Division I, II, or III, are generally hover between 5 and 10% for most sports. The best odds are for girl ice hockey players. 23% of women ice hockey players who play in high school can play on their college team.
But still, with the cost of a college education, is a scholarship still something that kids should aspire to?
There's some interesting stuff going on there. First of all, the average scholarship is in the range of $13,000 to $15,000 a year. That's not going to go very far at most colleges. If your child wins that full ride lottery, important things to think about are that it's not a four-year ride. It's a one-year-at-a-time contingent ride. I think all the time there might be some exceptions to that that I'm not aware of. So the child has to remake the team every year. They get injured, no more scholarship. You know, they don't want to play anymore, certainly no more scholarship. And what college coaches that I've talked to have told me is that, you know, one thing to think about with that full-ride scholarship is that the team owns you. They own all of the time. They own the schedule. They have a say in what classes you can take, where you can be, what you do when you're not in class or on the field. It's really, really, really all-consuming if you are that athlete. And it might be great. If it's your kid's dream, wow, they should be going for it. If it's your dream, not so great.
Yeah, this is the big question, isn't it? You know, how much are kids being pushed by parents? But there is the very American story that, you know, some do make it, and also that if you try and work hard at any dream, you can achieve it. What's the downside of pushing that dream?
The downside of pushing this dream, if it's really all-consuming, is that kids miss out on other opportunities. The child who's spending all their time at the hockey rink or on the baseball field, all of their spare time with, you know, goalie coaches or pitching coaches, they're missing out on other opportunities. They're not spending that time with friends. They're not spending that time exploring other interests. To be really overly analytical about it, they're not spending that time and money on an algebra tutor. And that might be a better choice if you're looking to help your child get into college.
Well, you're certainly not saying kids should not participate in team sports.
No. I mean, all four of my kids play hockey. And we love it. It's really important, and they get a lot of great stuff out of this. They have a good time. They enjoy being with their teammates. They develop social skills. They develop resilience. I mean, one great thing that you can get in sports that's hard to find anywhere else is it's win or lose. You got to take those losses home and, you know, find a way to deal with the fact that maybe you blew the game, or maybe you think your teammate did, or maybe you guys just weren't as good as the other team. And I think that's a fantastic experience. But it's important to be doing it for the right reasons. We're doing it for fun. We're doing it for health. We're doing it for, you know, companionship and entertainment, and because presumably the kids like it, because, you know, they're really enjoying themselves and they're getting that out of it. That's what's really important about playing a sport.
Well, KJ, is this a new phenomenon? I mean, there are more professional sports than ever. It would seem like there's even more opportunity.
I can't answer whether the number of parents that hope their children will go pro or that are dreaming of scholarship is a new phenomenon or not. It's probably relatively new with women because there weren't scholarships in women's sports until the late 70s at the earliest. So it's probably increasing. There are probably more perceived opportunities. I don't know that there are more actual opportunities, except for women, where I think you can't argue with the fact that they're really, to the extent that there are scholarships, there are certainly more than there were, you know, 25 years ago.
Okay. Well, KJ, thank you for keeping our feet on the ground today.
Thanks for having me.
KJ Dell'Antonia, she's lead writer and editor of the New York Times Motherlode blog, where she wrote the article, Odds Are Your Sport-Playing Child Is Not Going Pro. Now what? You'll find a link to read it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so counting on your kid going pro may not be the most realistic use of resources. That doesn't mean they won't find sports fulfilling in their adult life. But for a group of women in a small Cape Cod town, the dream of playing roller derby came true. Producer Phoebe Flanagan introduces us to the founders of the Cape Cod Roller Derby League. He took the
bomb. Talia Mama is my derby name.
This is Jackie Ono.
My derby name is Darthritis.
Emma Getcha.
Mini Demolish.
Boom Boom Kitty.
Mayday.
Generally Heartless.
Dream Reaver. Smack Frost. Mighty Medge is our fresh meat coach. She is mighty. Luna. Okay, can you come up? This is like all day. They just want me to hold them both. Luna's barking. That's right.
I'm Lynn Duquette-Pereira, the co-founder of Cape Cod Roller Derby.
Oh, I need socks. Socks, socks.
And my roller derby name is Lulu Nori Morse.
I've got my skates. I've got my flyers. Okay. Yay.
So, yeah, the transition of leaving the house, it's crazy. Usually my head is going a million miles an hour. I'm, like, all over the place. And then I leave, and I'm like, okay. I can breathe. I'm not taking care of anyone right now. I'm going to Derby. It's funny, though, when we started it, Talia and I, we knew nothing about it. So we didn't even have roller skates. but I just posted on Facebook. I was like, we should start a roller derby league on the Cape. And Talia, like, jumped on it. She was like, let's do it. And, you know, the next day she had called all the rinks on the Cape and found a place. And I was like, whoa, this is really happening.
We actually were both kind of trying to get pregnant at the same time. So we kind of formed a bond over that. We're like, we need to eat this food because, you know, it's better for fertility. And then we, oddly enough, both had a miscarriage at the same time. Both of us, it happened on Christmas Eve. And that was a rough thing to go through, but it was kind of nice to have somebody that was going through it too.
This is we luckily found this place. They were renting the back of it. It's scary when we have guests come. They're like, where are you taking me? Old warehouse, the very last door, but it's awesome. We call it the dollhouse. So right now the girls are just kind of skating it out, warming up. Most women have to kind of put on a mask sometimes, be the mom and fit a certain mold. And then here you don't really have to. You just put on your fishnets and show off your tattoos and be tough and awesome. Usually we're listening to, like, the Pixies or the... what's a song that everybody always wants to listen to?
Eye of the Tiger.
We do listen to Eye of the Tiger a lot.
It would be rude not to.
I'm Talia Aroni. I co-founded the team with Lynn.
It's super makeshift. It's like wicked thrown together, but it works. That's the most amazing thing about it, I think, is it's from scratch.
This time, you need to be listening for your teammates.
A lot of my friends and family thought I was like nuts. They weren't like, I want to do that. You know what I mean? They were like, good luck. People thought we'd break our faces or get punched. There's this stigma with it, that it's super violent and the women are crazy and rowdy, and it's not like that at all. The women are strong and passionate. It's a big difference.
Ready?
Everybody changed. People changed. I mean, people's bodies changed. Personalities changed. I felt so confident. I mean, when we first started and wearing the sweatshirt, I don't think I've ever felt so strong in my life. Never as much as when I was wearing a Cape Cod Roller Derby hoodie and, like, walking through the grocery store with, like, cool socks on and my tight pants. And, you know, people would be like, you do roller derby? And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I do. And it felt really good. I'm like, yeah.
You become obsessed with it. Like, you don't want to do anything else. Like, you're like, I need to roller skate. If I'm home, I need to watch roller derby bouts. I need to, like, skate in my kitchen. You know, yeah. It's just like, it becomes your whole life. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work, though. It is a lot of work. I mean, people don't sometimes realize the behind-the-scenes stuff with the paperwork and the insurance and taxes. And it's just like, basic Italia and I do everything.
I remember my husband would just be like, hey, hi. Remember me? Like, we used to talk and stuff.
We call our husbands derby widows.
Yeah, it's true.
They're all derby widows.
There's no day off. There really isn't. But I think it's been healthy. I mean, I know for my oldest, it's been really cool for him to see mom come up with an idea and make it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's roller derby or some big business, whatever it is, you just kind of make it happen and you don't stop. I think our goal is another bout. A bout is a roller derby game. We had our first big bout and it was huge.
I mean, it blew our minds. 500 people.
It felt like I was at a concert. I was like, this is insane.
Cameras flashing.
Yeah.
And, you know, people had signs up and we were like, whoa.
This is only just going to keep growing. That's it. There's too much momentum. It's already kind of driving itself. I mean, Lynn and I are steering it, but there's too much, too many people that are just too madly in love with it.
See you later.
And that piece was produced by Phoebe Flanagan at the Transom Storytelling Workshop. Roller derby often gets a bad rap for being a violent sport that attracts aggressive people looking for a fight. But it's nothing compared to the violent, hard-scrabble experience of selling T-shirts during the dog years at Fenway Park. We'll hear the outrageous story behind the creators of the Yankee Suck T-shirt when Word of Mouth continues.
If you're a big Red Sox fan, there's a pretty good chance that you also hate the New York Yankees. For many years, an impromptu chorus of Yankees suck would erupt at Fenway Park, no matter who the Sox were playing. That rivalry and that phrase gave rise to the Yankees Suck t-shirts, which were produced on a shoestring by a bunch of hardcore punks and went on to become the most popular t-shirts in Boston history. Amos Barshad is staff writer for Grantland, and he follows the rise and fall of the drug-fueled, violent, and highly lucrative empire behind the once ubiquitous shirt. Amos Barshad, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So you write about the very first Yankee Suck t-shirt, actually a promotion for a hardcore band. So what's that connection there between the Boston music scene and sports at that time?
There was a group of guys who used to sell peanuts and beer and water and stuff inside Fenway. And a lot of these guys, the way they knew each other was from going to hardcore shows and playing in hardcore bands, which in that genre of music was very popular in Boston at the time, kind of late 90s, early 2000s. And so just by being around Fenway and all of them being big Sox fans, you know, they would hear the Yankees Suck chant all the time. And, you know, you'd see it on a shirt here and there or, you know, whatever it would be, maybe a homemade one. You know, that kind of thing existed. You know, it was out there. But no one had really tried to industrialize it in any way. So kind of on a whim, these guys, to celebrate the last show but from one of their favorite bands, 10 Yard Fight, they printed up a bunch of shirts that said Yankees Suck on the front and 10-Yard Fight on the back with the date of the last show. And, you know, they were just kind of doing it for their friends and the fellow fans and not thinking too much about it. But, you know, it was a big hit. They were surprised at how easily they were managed to sell them. And soon thereafter, they decided to kind of go into business specifically with these shirts.
Well, tell us a little bit about that evolution, going from being a way to make a couple bucks and acknowledge a band's last gig to a substantial business operation with its own printing press and distribution system of sorts.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way they tell it, it all happened so fast, and they just kind of had to keep up. You know, at first, they were using a guy in New Jersey who printed up a lot of the hardcore band's shirts. You know, the way, you know, hardcore works in a lot of punk bands too, it's like you're not necessarily in it to make money, you're in it to have a good time. So you form bands and you break up pretty quickly as soon as you stop having fun. So, you know, these guys would just throw out a quick orders of shirts through this guy. So it would just always be like limited order stuff. But once these guys realized that they wanted to keep this going and they realized they could make some money doing it, they branched out, they rented a place. And they just kind of started calling in all their pals, all these kids that were, you know, punk kids, you know, some of them in school, some of them are not, just all of them, you know, looking to make money and looking to hang out. So they quickly had like packs of guys working for them, working the entrances to Fenway, working certain spots. And at the time, they just popped up out of nowhere and, you know, could stand right there, right outside where the reputable businesses were and just kind of, you know, hawking these cheaper, funnier, cruder shirts and kind of stealing attention away from everyone. And they were, you know, brash young kids. And so they just loved to just get in there and mix it up with, you know, Sox fans, drunk or not. You know, everyone kind of yelled at each other. It became this rambunctious scene at any given time, you know, before and after the game when everyone was streaming in and out.
So who was in this group and how many people were in their kind of core group and then the extended distribution network?
There was, you know, four main guys, this guy Ray Lemoine and his friends, Todd Wilson, Jamie Manza, and another guy called Eric Ferenc, and everyone called him Rusty. And they were the main guys that kind of spearheaded the whole thing. You know, classic like heist movie. They all kind of had some roles, you know, allocated out. You know, Ray was kind of more of the leader of the brains. Todd Wilson was known to be a bit more of the enforcer. You know, Jamie and Rusty were more behind the scenes and maybe a bit more party forward kind of guys. But you know, more or less, they were all just friends and excited about the music and excited about the Sox and excited more than anything that they had all this money, all this cash to spend in ridiculous ways together.
So they sort of sound like drug dealers, and you kind of compare the way that they set up their operation a little bit like drug dealers. How's that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think for the longest time when I was working on the story and trying to explain it to people, I was referring to them as baby drug dealers. And, you know, I think that's true, and I think they were happy to go along with it. I mean, of course, selling, you know, t-shirts that where the copyright is in question is not comparable to selling drugs, but these guys were happy to play the part at the very least. And I think there always was a bit of a kind of a winking recognition that this was all a bit ridiculous, you know. But, you know, they did have the cops on them after a little while, and specifically the code enforcers. And they did have this guy, Chris Tiger Stockbridge, and he was the one known to be the most vigilant from the code enforcers. At the same time, he was a quite large man, so there would be a lot of, you know, kind of comical foot races between a grown adult of a certain size chasing these skinny young kids around all through Fenway. You know, it would just be scenes like that would pop up all the time. So it's like, you know, you're thinking about it as if you're being watched, and you know you're doing something that's quasi-illegal, so, you know, why not embrace the whole mentality and pretend to be these outlaw kids? And, you know, that's kind of what they did. You know, they made their money fast, they spent it fast, they all lived together in these kind of flop houses in the Mission Hill neighborhood of Boston, and they, you know, embraced a certain kind of lifestyle that would, you know, generally be in line with something of a more extreme illegality.
Well, paint a picture for us of this house that they're all living in and their travels, the way that they sort of move around as a posse, to give us a sense of, like, how debauched this really was.
I mean, the way I understand it, they went from not doing much of anything. Hardcore music is associated with straight edge, which is a movement basically that if you say you're straight edge, you don't drink, you don't do drugs, you're very careful about, you know, what you do with your body. And a lot of these kids had come out of that. And, you know, it's not to say just because they had money that they started breaking edge, as it's called, but it seemed to certainly not hurt, because all of a sudden they had money to buy pills. You know, Vicodin was rampant. You know, it became a thing where they had this house in Mission Hill, and they named it the Gentleman's Club. And basically, people knew if you were looking for a party, you could stop by there at any given time. And, you know, people passed out on the couches, passed out on the floors. You know, any given room was a wreck, and drugs and booze and, you know, sometimes strippers. You know, it's like you have money and you're just trying to figure out ways to blow it. I mean, that's basically what it was. Any kind of vice they could get their hands on, they love to take part in.
Yeah, I can kind of imagine the montage and even the music for the Ben Affleck-directed film of this now.
Yeah, if he's listening, you know, holler at me after.
Any idea how much money they were making?
It's hard to say. Any given night, they'd maybe have 20 or so guys out there, and then each of those guys is making, like, taking home maybe $100 or something. It's hard to say who was getting what cut. You know, the four main guys would kind of get a cut off of every shirt. But, you know, they're printing these shirts for 50 cents or a dollar. So, you know, easily get up to tens of thousands on any given week, depending on, of course, if the Sox are home and if the Yankees are there, which, of course, leads to more sales. And, you know, certain days, you know, sales would spike. You know, they always talked about Marathon Day, Patriots Day. So, you know, there's certain days where they knew how to work it more. And certain sellers were just, you know, more active. There was this one kid that everyone talked about, Jonathan Cho, and he apparently, you know, just kind of see guys coming out, throw a shirt on before they could even say anything, be like, all right, that's $10, you know, just hustling. You know, they're out there just pushing it and hustling. And if you wanted to, you know, you could really get some nice pocket money for yourself.
Well, at some point they were, you know, wearing expensive watches, traveling to Europe, you know, having these sort of junkets like drug dealers do. And you refer to them as the suckers. Is that how they talk about themselves, or is that a name that you gave them?
They would say, you know, let's talk about the days of sucking or something like that. They would kind of make it into a verb. I think the suckers came out through the story. You know, we needed a way to identify the group. But, yeah, they would kind of jokingly be like, oh, let's reminisce about the old days of sucking. They would have that kind of terminology.
Was what they were doing legal?
You know, it's hard to say that it was fully legal. But in their defense, the phrase Yankee suck wasn't trademarked. So as far as that goes, it wasn't necessarily a copyright infringement. There are certain rules about where you can sell your goods in relation to other businesses. So I think, you know, in the sense of fair businessman practices, they were probably infringing on things like that. But, you know, as their lawyer said to me, you know, ultimately you were these young guys who figured out how to make money. You know, there was obviously a demand for this. They were tapping into something that really was there, you know, that kind of bitterness and the hatred, and of course that phrase. It was almost inevitable that someone would be able to make money doing this. And I think, you know, they weren't that interested in becoming a reputable business. They enjoyed doing it the way they wanted to. The truth is, if they had looked to set up a brick and mortar store or something like that, maybe that's a route they could have gone down. But that was not something they were interested in. You know, I think they were enjoying playing with the gray area. I mean, I think even the cops were you know, aware that it wasn't absolutely clear what was legal and what was not, because up to that point, you know, you had the stores, you had the guys inside Fenway selling. There just wasn't this situation where there were guys running around selling shirts out of trash bags. So they had to kind of figure it out as they went along. The way they say it, you know, they'd have their shirts confiscated by cops just because, you know, the cops were going to like a barbecue the next day and wanted to hand the shirts out to their friends. You know, they claimed that certain times, you know, they'd go in front of judges and the judge would be like, all right, you get off and toss me a shirt, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it's Boston, you know, the judge is most likely a Sox fan and hates the Yankees. So it's really hard for him to see this kid selling Yankee Sox shirts and not have some compassion towards him.
Well, it's huge success. So, of course, other vendors were trying to step on their stuff, too, and print their own Yankee Suck material. How did they deal with those infringers?
Yeah, there was definitely a spike in competition once they realized that would happen. It seemed, for the most part, it was kind of piecemeal. You know, a guy would show up with a couple of his buddies and be like, well, you guys are doing it. Why can't we? And, of course, he was absolutely right to do it or attempt to. But the fact is, you know, that's not how these guys saw it. So in their opinion, that was grounds for physical confrontation, at the very least some verbal. And, you know, there was incidents where guys' shirts were being thrown, you know, onto the Mass Pike, or someone would dump a soda all over them. You know, just make it very clear that it was going to be a hostile environment if you're going to show up and try to do that. And again, you know, I think the way they tell the stories, you know, they're aware of the ridiculousness of having a turf war over T-shirts. But, you know, that's what it came down to. And so if that was going to happen, that's how they were going to play it. You know, if people wanted to try and get in on their game, you know, it was going to have to be a battle over it.
I'm speaking with Amos Barshad, staff writer for Grantland, and he recently chronicled the bizarre history of the Yankees Suck T-shirt and the gang-like group of kids made hundreds of thousands of dollars banking on the long and bitter sports rivalry between the Yankees and the Red Sox. Well, things really changed for the Yankees Suck T-shirt in the 2004 World Series win for the Red Sox. How did that change Fenway Park and the nature of the Suckers' business?
The win is so funny because it's obviously was so coveted for so long, but that's the thing. Once you win, you're not an underdog anymore. And the identity of Boston and Sox in particular was of this plucky underdog and, you know, getting beat always at the last minute, but always being in there and fighting and, you know, making sure to display all the heart that they had. And once you win, and, you know, obviously the Sox budget payroll is not that dissimilar to the Yankees, all of a sudden what's to stop you from just becoming the new Yankees? And, you know, in large part that is what happened. You know, there were all these bandwagon fans. The pink hat became something where people debated a lot. You know, you'd see kind of new fans, maybe younger female fans who are enjoying the good spirited nature that comes after a championship. And of course, why wouldn't they? And, you know, going along with it, going out to buy a new pink hat. And you'd have all these like crusty old Boston dudes just being like, they're not real fans. They weren't there in the beginning, you know, and it's a funny thing. And also represents, I think, the changing of the city and especially the changing of the area surrounding Fenway. I think people that were there back then remember it was a dirtier, grimier place. It was the kind of place that you really could get in a fight if you were looking for it, and sometimes if you weren't. I spoke with Peter Gammons, you know, the great, great baseball writer who was at the Globe for a long time and ESPN, and, you know, he was remembering being at games with his wife and people cursing and him having to turn around and ask for them to stop cursing in front of kids. Like, this was a regular thing you'd have to do. And these days at Fenway, you know, it's definitely a premier family-friendly outing, and it's just bizarre and it's great. You know, ultimately, of course, you want people to feel safe and you want things to be clean. But you know, for me and for other people that were there observing that back around then, I grew up in Brookline, which is a suburb outside of Boston. So it wasn't like I was there throwing punches or anything. But, you know, I just remember hearing stories and seeing, you know, kind of a dirtier, grimier place. And it's silly, but, you know, you can really get nostalgic for something like that.
Yeah, I've seen a number of sports writers just say, it's time to retire the whole Yankees Suck thing. What's your thought?
You know, I will always have some residual hatred for them. I don't even, you know, to be fully honest, I kind of stopped watching baseball after that World Series win as well. I just kind of lost some interest, as weird as it is. The truth is that, yeah, you know, it doesn't represent what it did. And the rivalry isn't as bitter. And so when you hear it now, it's almost strange, you know, kind of if someone were to try to burst out with it, I can imagine, you know, hearing some silence, you know, echoing afterwards. But, you know, for a time there was just wherever you were, if there was a group of people, you know, you would hear that. I mean, people that I talked to remember hearing it at funerals, even bar mitzvahs, weddings, you know, insane things like that.
So
and I remember
crazy.
I remember after the Pats won, the Patriots won in 2001, we all streamed down to Kenmore Square and celebrated, and it was an amazing, joyous thing. And it took about 45 seconds for some genius to start yelling "Yankees suck," and it had nothing to do with anything, but it was just the loudest I've ever heard a group of people yell "Yankees suck" after the Patriots had won the Super Bowl. It made no sense.
Well, it has been more than a decade since the Red Sox won in 2004. And one of the people that you speak to says, you know, looking outside of Fenway Park now, it looks like Dubai. And I've been there recently. It's absolutely transformed. So where are the Suckers now? What are they doing?
They're kind of all over the place. I think a part of the story that drew me to it was that they did have some splintering. The way they talked about it is, you know, they didn't necessarily work on their relationship. You know, they realized they were kind of living fast, and as soon as that money starts falling apart, or people start arguing about money, or as soon as there was just more trouble related to operating their business, it stopped being as fun, and some of them kind of splintered away. But they're all doing well in their own respective regards. Ray LeMoyne is a journalist. I think he's currently still in the Ukraine. And Jamie Manza is out in upstate New York, involved with it's called Cobb Building. It's kind of an organic building technique. Mm-hmm. Todd Wilson is in Albany, you know, doing construction. You know, these guys are kind of all over the place doing their own thing, and those guys don't really talk. But LeMoyne is still close with a lot of the guys that he sold shirts with, and they're all still buddies.
Well, an amazing story. Thank you so much for talking with us about it, Amos.
Thank you for having me.
Amos Barshad, he's staff writer for Grantland, and you'll find a link to read his absolutely entertaining article for Grantland about the rise and fall of the Suckers at wordofmouthradio.org. Okay, so we've been talking about sports today, but before we go, we did want to let you know about a show that's coming up in New Hampshire this week. You're listening to The Bad Plus doing its version of the Nirvana classic Smells Like Teen Spirit. It's a track from their 2003 album, These Are the Vistas. Featuring an impressive mix of original songs and unlikely covers, it was an album that proved The Bad Plus is a rare bird in the music world, an accessible jazz band that still has room for experimentation. Now more than 10 years and a handful of critically acclaimed albums later, The Bad Plus is experimenting with a fourth member, saxophonist Joshua Redman. The Bad Plus is Ethan Iverson on piano, David King on drums, and Reed Anderson on bass. You can see them perform with Joshua Redman at Dartmouth in Hanover on Tuesday, October 13th. To find out more about the band and the new collaboration with Joshua Redman, producer Taylor Quimby spoke with bassist Reed Anderson.
So part of what makes jazz fun to listen to, and I think probably fun to play, I would think, is the improvisational nature of the genre. But you guys are big enough as a band that people also, you know, they want to hear what they know from the album. So how do you play that sort of balancing act during your live performances?
Well, the improvisation is always just built in. So, you know, we're very song-oriented in our approach. And we're very conscious of music that has this kind of pop sensibility. So there's always something that will be familiar. You know, the song should be familiar if you've heard it, if you're a fan of the song. But there's always improvisation within that structure.
Now, you've been playing as a trio for over a decade, so I imagine that's a long time to really get to know, you know, just how to improvise with one another. What was it like bringing Joshua Redman into the group for this latest album?
It was incredibly easy and natural. He's a great musician, and, you know, I think even though we have created this kind of, you know, world of our own, it's still a very, you know, understandable world for somebody of Josh's caliber.
Is there a song off the album with Joshua Redman that's like a favorite track for you off the album?
Oh, gosh. You know, I love them all. I think Dave King's song, Dave is the drummer in the Bad Plus, Beauty Has It Hard is really great. You know, it's a very, you know, hypnotic kind of song. And it has basically kind of two halves. One half is this kind of introducing the material and building up to a certain point. And then it kind of restarts. And there's this long build to the end where Joshua really, you know, Dave really wanted this to be a platform for him to kind of take off soloistically.
Band does get a lot of attention for the covers, which I think, I imagine it's kind of a way in for listeners who might not be very well schooled in jazz. And I wonder, how do you just pick covers based off tracks that you really love, or is there sort of a process to it?
There is a process, but it's not really a knowable process, even to us. But it has to have something to do with, you know, we have to like the song.
Hello. Is there anybody in there? Just knock if you can hear me. Is there anyone home?
It also has to be conveyable with our instrumentation, you know, like some pop music that we might like a lot. You might not be able to get the point across with piano, bass, and drums for, you know, whatever, melodic or structural reasons. So we have to feel like we can, you know, convey the song and also make it our own in some way.
Relax, I need some information first. Just the basic facts. Can you show me where? There is no pain you are receiving.
So you're a bassist, and I feel like bassists sometimes in the rock and roll world kind of get a bad rap. Like they end up being made fun of as like the guy who doesn't get girls, or just, you know, weird stereotypes like that. And I think in the jazz world, like, you get to be way more front and center. Like, your role seems to be more instrumental to the group. And I wonder what you think about those stereotypes of the bassist in popular culture.
Oh, gosh. you know, I think it's a fact that, you know, the bass has a much less readily understandable function in the music. You know, when you see a great saxophone soloist out there, or a great pianist or drums, you know, there's something that you can all, you know, immediately understand about, like, okay, wow, this is really impressive. Whereas the function of the bass in music is a much more subliminal one a lot of the time. So I guess that kind of lends itself to, you know, what you're talking about, that kind of perception. Also, there's a certain truth to, like, if, you know, the jokes about, like, okay, well, you don't really have to know that much to play bass in certain contexts. but, you know, some of the most important musicians that, you know, in shaping the music are bass players like Charlie Hayden.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's
you're done.
That's all I have to say on the subject.
And that was
was Taylor Quimby speaking with bassist Reed Anderson of The Bad Plus. You can see them perform at Dartmouth on Tuesday, October 13th with Joshua Redman. And there's more information at nhpr.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you can't catch the show during the week, you can catch it in its entirety at the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please write a review. It helps us in the iTunes ranking so other people can discover Word of Mouth for themselves. And as we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from listener-supported New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.